This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Failing Up, written and performed by Leslie Odom Jr.
Prologue. Take me to the world. Take me to the world that's real. Show me how it's done. Stephen Sondheim. From the teleplay Evening Primrose. Late one night in early 2016, some months before my final performance as Aaron Burr in Hamilton, an American musical, I found myself alone in a darkened Richard Rogers theater. I paused for a moment to take it all in. For the next week, I would be on a beach in Mexico with my wife, Nicolette, an overdue and much-needed vacation. After the curtain call, I'd spent a while straightening up my dressing room. I packed a large box with some personal effects. I tried to leave things tidy for the new guys. Burr would belong to the understudies in the building for the next week. There were three, and they were ecstatic. Who could blame them? It was the role of a lifetime, and for the following 7 days, it was all theirs. My tiny dressing room had slowly accumulated piles of workout clothes, extra pairs of shoes, books, snacks, drawings, letters, and small gifts from fans. It was my home away from home. I did my best to thin it out in there. The new Burrs deserved a clean slate. Angelo, the late-night doorman at the Rogers, had just bounced. "Les, stay as long as you want," he told me. "When you leave, make sure you don't forget anything. The door locked behind you." The Cancun flight was early in the a.m., but before I took off, I made a sharp right outside my dressing room and followed the familiar path to the stage entrance. I'd never been completely alone in the theater before. Looking out at the empty seats, I took a mental snapshot, doing my best not to forget anything. For 2 years, Hamilton had been such an enormous part of my life. The changes in the wake of the Broadway opening had been so seismic that sometimes there were nights like this one, when I would spend a few moments trying to piece together, understand how. Hamilton was the dream that almost didn't happen. Only 5 years prior to encountering Lin-Manuel Miranda's masterpiece, I had made the decision to move on from the business of being an actor. I found myself at one of life's most common rites of passage, a graduation, and I knew from past experience that there would be things I'd have to leave behind. Some things don't travel well from one time in your life to the next, like broken-down rides and ratty furniture, bad habits, toxic relationships, unhealthy thought patterns. There should be shedding around graduation day. The old stuff will only weigh you down. On the threshold of a milestone birthday, I questioned whether I needed to lighten up. Graduating into my 30s felt significant. The instability and unpredictability of the artist's path was starting to feel like a child's way to live. Things may have been intensified by another rite of passage that I knew little about at the time. There's a cosmic correlation that happens around the age of 29 known to astrologers as the Saturn return. The slow-moving planet Saturn takes 29 and a half years to complete its orbit around the sun and return to the exact same spot in the sky as it was the day you were born. The Saturn return is notoriously disruptive, known for upheaval and thrusting things taken for granted into question. Whether or not you believe in those influences, and I take it all with a few grains of salt, it makes sense that whenever you hit that natural cusp between your extended younger years and adulthood, you can expect uncertainty and apprehension with the onrush of big change. I was taking stock of where I was at 29 and seriously pondering the real possibility that if I didn't make some different choices, who's to say I wouldn't be in the same exact spot at 39? My chosen path offered so few assurances. Who's to say I wouldn't be in the exact same spot at 49, life on fast forward had me circling the drain. Some paradigm-shifting advice from a mentor and practical application brought me from one of the saddest times in my life to a Broadway stage at what felt like the center of the theatrical universe for a time. And wait, what time is it? Cancun! I stepped out of the Richard Rogers Theater and into the frigid New York City night air. The stage door dumps you into the alley behind the theater. The big metal door slammed and locked behind me as my buddy Angelo promised. A preview. There was another graduation looming. Only 6 months left of Hamilton on Broadway for me. I mean, there had been so much hard work to get here, and I was already halfway over. Can't stay in one place forever. Box of personal effects in hand, I kept walking. My apartment was a short 15-minute walk from work. It was along the trek that night that the first principles for the conversation at the heart of this book came to mind. In part to keep warm, I got my legs moving as fast as my thoughts were that night. Now, I've had a profound appreciation for the role of the mentor since elementary school. My fifth-grade social studies teacher was the first. As a kid with some behavioral issues, my story would have unfolded in a drastically different way without people who cared. I've included some of the greatest lessons I've learned at their instruction in the chapters of this book. Among the mentors was, and is, a Los Angeles acting-slash-life-slash-empowerment coach, expert boggle champ, and Renaissance man named Stuart K. Robinson. Remember that name? He's a brilliant guy whose practical wisdom has changed many lives, and I swear I'd say the same thing even if he hadn't let me marry his daughter. In the throes of my Saturn return crisis, I asked Stu if he had any time to talk. He'd helped people through career transitions before. We met for food, and after listening thoughtfully to all the reasons why I had decided to leave the business, sick of this, tired of that, regular depression, tokenism, student loans, no money, add complaint here, Stuart paused for a moment to make sure I was prepared to hear him. I sat up in my seat ready to listen. He began, "Les, of course you can quit. That's fine. And we can talk about what you might do next and how to go about it. I can support you in that. But I'd love to see you try before you quit." Try. What did he mean, try? As a working actor for over a decade, I had the wounds, calluses, and IMDb credits to show for it. When an opportunity presented itself, you'd be hard-pressed to find many people who tried harder. Stuart knew this, and still he was looking at me and telling me he wanted me to try. He said, "You know how to succeed when the phone is ringing, but what about when the phone's not ringing?" Stu went on, "What did you do for yourself today? Did you call anyone? In what ways did you take charge of your creative life today? Did you send an email to someone who might be working on something you care about? Did you read anything? Did you write anything? Did you take a class? Did you practice? What step forward did you take for yourself today in the absence of the ringing phone?" The solution was so simple, it had completely eluded me. Stu was reminding me of that thing we all know deep down. If you are willing to take one meaningful step on your own behalf toward making a dream come true today, the universe will meet you where you are and help you take two. The universe will never shortchange you. When you take steps to better yourself, it is never in vain. Make no mistake, following your dream has a spiritual component as well. You will train and prepare to actualize your dreams in countless ways. Try not to neglect the spiritual fortification. For some, it's a vulnerability point they don't realize until the need becomes dire. Stu's advice led me back to class. It led to a more consistent ratio of bookings when the phone was ringing. It led to a focus on music, live performing, and independent work when the phone was not ringing. It led me in a direct and traceable line all the way to Hamilton and the most creatively fulfilling educational time of my life. It continues to this day. There was failure before, after too. In writing the book, I try to choose personal stories and life lessons to help illustrate my thesis that spectacular failure is the secret ingredient to your ultimate success. You will learn and grow from the former at a rate far greater than the latter. Almost home now. Lin-Manuel Miranda stalked an impulse, an inspiration for 6 years. He is, among many things, a master editor, as well as a monster with a pen. Lin's a guy who can tell you about failure. He'll write you a song about it, and the song will make you weep. And once the world was introduced to his passion and craftsmanship, he's a guy who can tell you all about success, too. He picked up Ron Chernow's biography about a complicated historical figure and wrote an entire musical odyssey that begins with the question, how? He tracks the founding of a nation in the 3-hour roller coaster ride that follows as he pulls pieces together to discover how a bastard orphan, son of a whore, born in squalor in a forgotten spot in the Caribbean, grows up to be a hero and a scholar. I love questions that begin with how. They activate the listener. You become a historian or a detective, piecing together your findings and following your intuition on the way to your response. We learn from the pages of history who we are and who we have been. We learn from our greatness and from our darkness. We cannot predict the future, but studying where we've been helps us better understand where we are. We learn how we can do better. Predictions are overrated. On the Hamilton stage, alone, looking out at the empty seats, no one could have predicted the place where we'd found ourselves from the place where we began. And while no one can predict exactly where your ingenuity, your perseverance, your willingness to fail spectacularly will lead you, the smart money is on up. Go get it. The game's afoot, and the game is good. Chapter 1. The Mentor. When a man starts out to build a world, he starts first with himself. Langston Hughes. The delicate balance of mentoring someone is not creating them in your own image, but giving them the opportunity to create themselves. Steven Spielberg. How? How do you figure out what it is you're really meant to do in this life? How do you find your point of entry? How do you begin? A few people I've met seem to have been born to their calling, with gifts and dreams that stood out early on. Most of us don't fall into that category. Most of us have no idea at the start what we're meant to do, or even what we're capable of. Some of us don't find our thing so much as it finds us. And sometimes, it's only because of some special person who introduces us to possibilities we might never have imagined for ourselves. Like many others, I have an early educator to thank for helping me make that initial connection. Mrs. Frances Turner was my 5th grade social studies teacher and my very first mentor. I was a rowdy, unfocused 10-year-old when I arrived in her classroom, and I can't say we hit it off right away. Back then, I couldn't think of a subject more dry and joyless than social studies, and I held Mrs. Turner in contempt for having voluntarily chosen it at some point as the subject she would teach. What kind of a person would choose social studies? Mrs. Turner never smiled. She was all business and immune to my limited charms. What bothered me most, Frances seemed to understand me in a way that was unsettling. I was a handful. That had been the case since kindergarten back in New York, where I spent the first 7 years of my life. In my kindergarten classroom, we had what was known as the sad face box. It looked very much like the name suggests. It was a box drawn each day in the bottom left corner of the blackboard. At the top of the box, Miss Lewis drew, well, a sad face. It looked kind of like the emoji. Names of the students who broke rules would go into the box. She kept a running tally of naughty kids, and mine was, without fail, the very first name in that stupid box every single day. Half the time, it would be so early in the day that she hadn't even gotten around to drawing the thing yet when I'd give her a reason to reach for her chalk. I'd purposely speed through an assignment so she'd be faced with the hassle of finding me something else to do, or I would crack a joke that only my section of the room could hear and get a bunch of toddlers riled up. Miss Lewis would draw that sad face and put a box around it in a fit of rage. She'd break the chalk pressing too hard as she spelled out my name. You could feel her wishing it had more letters or that she could add punctuation after it. She'd be so pissed off. L-E-S-L-I-E, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. Children who were well-behaved for the remainder of the day would find their names erased from the box as easily as they'd been written. In a particularly nice touch from Miss Lewis, before the end of each day, she would find a way to erase all the names still left inside the sad face box. If, for a full minute, you could manage to sit with your hands folded, your back straight, and your mouth zipped, if you could find some discipline and self-control for the final minute of the day, you'd start the following day with a clean slate. A kindergarten teacher's lesson in redemption was also baked into the box. Still, I didn't have the tools yet to understand how to make myself behave like the other kids. I had no clue how to begin to put my energy to better use. It would take 5 more years and the help of a no-nonsense social studies teacher to help me figure that out. As I got older, I realized that part of my problem was the fact that I was one of those kids who felt, to himself anyway, like an adult on the inside. After I turned 30, I thought, yeah, this is the age I felt like since I was 8, maybe even younger. As a kid, I had trouble with rules and unquestioned authority. My mouth got me into a fair amount of trouble. I wanted to know why I was being asked to do a particular thing before I was going to do it. Put your heads down. Hand raised and question posed in a polite but thinly veiled accusatory tone. Why? If you finish your quiz before the bell, use the extra time to check your work and no talking. In a tone laced with suspicion and distrust. Why? Today I understand that in classrooms filled with more than 30 other students, my teachers didn't have the seconds or the energy to take my earnest but ill-timed questions to heart. Back then, I wanted my concerns to be on the record. Mom and Dad were fairly strict. If I found myself in some sort of trouble at school, I knew my transgressions would always have to be defensible. There would have to be a gray area that I could highlight. There would have to be their side and my side. When I pleaded my case at home, there needed to be nuance and perspective, or my goose would be cooked. My parents would always hear me out. They would never take a teacher's word or anyone's word completely over mine. That was the law, never to be changed. Until one day, in the fall of 1991, when Francis Turner summoned my father for a parent-teacher conference one morning before school. Monday through Friday, Leslie Odom Sr. was wound tight, tight, tight. He had the shortest fuse of anyone I knew. Dad worked in sales. He spent the bulk of our childhood years, my baby sister Elizabeth came along when I was 6, climbing the ladder in corporate America, and while he rarely let the world know it, the pressure took a toll. Mom was Dad's partner in upward mobility. She worked in the field of recreation and rehabilitation therapy for as long as I can remember. Her pure goodness and capacity for empathy never ceased to amaze me. Yvette Marie Nixon filled my world with light. Always slow to anger where I was concerned, She was my first teacher. She taught me to add and subtract. She read to me, and eventually she taught me to read to myself. My little sister takes after my mom, sweet as can be. With two educated working parents, I understood their expectation of me extremely well and very early on. Dad's position was straightforward. The same way I go to work every day and your mother goes to work every day, that's what we expect from you. School is your job. No excuses. If I was falling down on my job and it made it harder for him to do his job, it wasn't just the anger and discipline to be meted out later that twisted my stomach in knots. It was also the fact that I was letting down the whole family unit. But I simply couldn't get it together in school. I was a prideful, mouthy kid with a bit of a short fuse myself, who couldn't resist the urge to make it known if an adult was being hypocritical or arbitrary. My mini crusades were almost always about some injustice. As I sat in the front seat of the car with my dad, driving to this meeting with Mrs. Turner, I had no way of gauging what he would think of her. Today, I have a better sense of how formidable she must have been in person. Frances Turner was brilliant, elegant, and economical in life and in her style as an educator. Frances was distinguished among her peers, and I always felt that she carried herself more like a tenured college professor than a fifth-grade social studies teacher. Well-read and well-traveled, Fran rocked a short cropped afro and one-of-a-kind frocks she'd picked up on outings to the Kenyan marketplace. There was a dignity and a regality in everything she did. I think it came from a clear understanding of her place in the world and of her personal power within it. She was charged with shaping minds. While it's true that in the first couple of weeks in her classroom I never saw her laugh, I never saw her scream either. She wouldn't have wasted even a bead of sweat on a behavioral issue. Not at Masterman, one of Philadelphia's prestigious and elite magnet schools which required testing and interviews to attend. Her attitude implied that if you were fortunate enough to be here, you would respect the privilege. Mrs. Turner ushered my father into a closed-door meeting in her classroom that morning. I waited in the hallway. The meeting extended on and on. Dad was in there forever. I could not see this ending well for me. When he emerged from the classroom 20 minutes later, nothing in his face gave me any hint whatsoever as to what the lady had said to him. "Enjoy your day. See you at home," he said. And then he was off. The tense goodbye told me all I needed to know about what would eventually happen when I saw my father at home that night. I spent the day working on my side. It was one of the longest school days that I can remember. That night, Dad came home from work. There was still no mention of the meeting. Dinner time came. I dragged myself to the table where the conversation was muted. When my father finally spoke, I was expecting his rage. Instead, he was measured. "I have never, ever taken somebody's word without hearing your side first. I've never done that." I waited for what was coming. "With Mrs. Turner, I will take her word. With Mrs. Turner, you don't have a side." The law had changed. I was on notice. If you misbehave in her classroom, or if you ever disrespect her again, you're going to have a real problem with me. And that was his final word on the matter. Dad had given Frances all the power. I let it sink in. See, my dad has always been tough on me, though my behavioral issues in school were tough on him. My folks were only a little older than children when they started a family and began having children themselves. I believe he really was doing his best. I believed it then, too. At the end of the day, I trusted my dad. And if he trusted Mrs. Turner, it meant that I could too. Trust opened the door to one of the most formative and valuable relationships of my young life. The tension and hostility faded away. Frances and I became congenial, even friendly, over the time after her meeting with my dad. I began to regard Mrs. Turner as someone in whom I could confide. Trust meant that when Mrs. Turner told me I should enter the citywide African-American oratorical competition because she felt I had a real shot at being a contender, I would take heed and get to work. Having a platform to speak my mind was unheard of. Like most 10-year-olds, I'd been told I was supposed to be seen and not heard. Now I was being encouraged to take a stand and speak truth to power in front of a room of adults. Kids from all over Philadelphia wrote and delivered original speeches. The orations were judged on content and delivery. Prizes and trophies went to the top scorers, but the greatest reward was seeing my potential in a new light. It's impossible for me to overstate the effect that oratory and the competition had on me as a young person. With patience and diligence and grace, Mrs. Turner led me to the writer and, in many ways, the warrior within me. Every kid needs an outlet, a world in which they can discover and see themselves at their best. The first year I entered the competition, my best wasn't quite good enough to win the grand prize. I came in second, but vowed I would be back the following year to try again. I failed to come in first, but I loved the process so much, I used my near miss as motivational fuel. When I hear people complain or bemoan coming close to a sought-after goal and missing by inches, I'm quick to reassure them. Celebrate the fight and the proud run. Coming close can be confirmation you're on the right path. What can you do better next time? What can you do to make yourself more prepared for the next time? Mrs. Turner was just as motivated. We went back to the drawing board. We retooled and re-entered the following year. For the next 4 years, the rest of my time in middle school, and even my first year of high school, my coach and I went undefeated in the Philadelphia competition. We had quite a run. Our winnings included thousands of dollars in savings bonds, which went directly to my college tuition in my first year, 2 brand new Apple desktop computers with printers, the very first computers my family owned, and a scholarship to begin studying drama, my first formal training of any kind, at Philadelphia's Freedom Theater, one of the oldest and most prestigious African-American repertory companies in the country. Located on Broad and Master Streets in North Philadelphia, the Freedom Theater was a rose growing out of the concrete. Inside the walls of Freedom was an oasis of learning and empowerment. Each student who entered the theater was greeted by Tom Page, the director of the training program. Page acted as threshold guardian, a job he took as seriously as a heart attack. You had to know the password to get past Mr. Page. It sent a message right away that inside these walls, there was something worthy of protection. "What's the password?" Mr. Page would ask. "I respect myself," you would offer. "You're beautiful," was always Tom's reply. To every single child who walked in, every single day. Maybe I would have found my way to Freedom Theater and to my eventual path without the guidance of Francis Turner, but I can't be sure. Oratory was the gateway to the theater, and Mrs. Turner helped me discover the password. She reframed notions that I was bound for trouble. She freed my voice and gave it back to me with style. Mrs. Turner was a vessel for small miracles. On the way up, there's plenty you can do on your own. There's a great deal in these chapters about how to make the best use of an hour of private time. The work you put in when no one is watching will matter far more than the work you do when the proverbial cameras are rolling. The private hours of hard work you dedicate in the dark will be their own testament when you're finally standing in your light. You can do a lot on your own, but no one can do it all alone. Who is your Francis Turner? Even if you aren't exactly where you'd like to be, I'm willing to bet that you have a host of people to thank for the best parts of your journey so far. There's a mentor, there's a teacher, There's a friend who believed in you. Let's make your rise to the top the way you say thank you to the person who helped you see your own magnificent potential. You've more than likely encountered bullies and naysayers on the path as well. There will always be people around us who are invested in proving their skepticism right. Make this the moment you wrestle your life back from the hands of bullies and the tormentors of your past and the ones you'll face tomorrow. This is your time. We owe it to our mentors and we owe it to ourselves. Onward. Chapter 2. The Big Break. Be more than ready. Start now every day becoming in your actions, your regular actions, what you would like to become in the bigger scheme of things. Anna Deavere Smith. I didn't want to be in show business. I wanted to be in Rent. I was 16 years old, and I had never seen a Broadway show, but I wanted to be in Rent on Broadway more than anything. Broadway was expensive. The best seats in the house could run upward of $75 a ticket. It's somewhat laughable today, but then it was too steep for our middle-class family of four. I didn't know anyone in show business, and for a long time, I don't think it even registered for me that these were jobs you could seek out. 20 years before Hamilton, Rent was also a far-reaching phenomenon with a hard-working team behind it doing their due diligence to ensure it was making noise on the national stage as well as in New York. I remember seeing the cover of Newsweek with Adam Pascal and Daphne Rubin Vega on newsstands. I remember watching a TV news magazine feature that gave us a glimpse inside what was happening at the Niederlande Theater on Broadway 8 times a week. The next day, I went to the record store to sample the cast album. Now, I'd meant only to listen to a song or two. 90 minutes later, I was still standing there, frozen. I was at the cash register 5 minutes after that, ponying up the $19.99 for my very own copy of the double disc recording, more than I'd ever spent on a single piece of art. For a long list of reasons, Rent was a revelation to me. I mean, I wanted to be friends with these people. I wanted to dress how they dressed and eat what they ate. I wanted to love how they loved. My heart took residence in the world Jonathan Larson created. The themes and motifs spoke to me like the Gospels. Friendship in the face of death. Love in the face of death. Art in the face of capitalism and consumerism. Protest in the face of injustice. This was my tribe. Jonathan Larson composed a tuneful and emotional Broadway score fashioned in modern rock and pop music. It sounded like music you'd hear on contemporary radio. It's a hard feat in the theater. It requires a unique talent. It requires someone who possesses skills as both classic storyteller and hit songwriter. It happens rarely, but when it does, the results can be magic. I knew every note and syllable of that score in a few weeks' time. A dream started for me here. I began to believe somewhere inside myself that I could will my way into the world that had captured my imagination. Star or roadie, usher or ensemble member, I didn't know what the capacity would be. But I believed that there could be, in or around the thing that I loved, a place with my name on it. And there is no wasted time in the company of something or someone that you love. Learning the songs, reading whatever I could get my hands on about the show and its humble beginnings at the New York Theater Workshop, soaking up the stories about Jonathan and the young cast of performers getting their big breaks, standing at the center of the phenomenon, it was all preparation for the far-off time when I would find myself immersed in that world. Though if someone would have told me how soon that immersion would arrive, I wouldn't have believed them. Nothing can stop you from preparing for your dream opportunity, but you can't know the day or the hour it'll come to you. You walk toward the things that make you feel most alive. You walk toward the things that you love. You love them with your whole heart. Read about them. Talk about them. Find other people who love those things too. And eventually, the thing you love most in the world will love you back. It is inevitable. Not always in the way you expect, but in exactly the way you need. The loving energy you put toward your dreams is magnified and returned to you in time. I was very lucky to come of age in Philadelphia at the time that I did, and I'm sure I didn't know it. Looking back to when and where my dream first took form, I realized I was a part of a whole group of young people who were on a similar path. Friends from my childhood went on to achieve great things in their chosen creative fields. America's fifth largest city, Philly is marked by a reverence for history, education, and the arts. Your hometown will shape your taste and your developing eye. Most of us travel a far distance from home in pursuit of the things we love most. But for better or worse, you take your hometown with you. Your hometown is the salt in the stew. Philadelphia is a huge part of who and why I am. It was at the Merriam Theater on Philadelphia's Avenue of the Arts where I first saw the touring production of Rent. The tour was in town for 6 weeks. I got a $20 student rush ticket and took in the show from the front row. The lights went down and my heart beat a little faster in my chest. I spent Act One with a big fat grin plastered on my face. The whole thing played like one continuous favorite song. When intermission came, my cheeks hurt from smiling so much and my head was swimming with the images I'd just witnessed. The show was perfect, even better than what I'd imagined after listening to the songs hundreds of times. Act Two began, and a small, seemingly insignificant, improvised moment between two actors on the stage, a flash of connection, burned into my memory banks and opened a brand new door in the annexes of my imagination. Okay, so from my front row seat, I clock an actor as he enters from stage right. He's wearing the most genuine and warm smile you can picture. There's a secret behind his eyes. He winks at a woman across the stage from him. It's quick, it's subtle, and if I wasn't in the front row, there's no way I would have noticed it. A similar smile creeps across the woman's face. She has a secret, too. They take their places among the rest of the cast with their smiles and secrets intact. They sing about seasons of love, and the remainder of Act Two unfolds from there. 525,600 minutes. Look, I'm not certain if anyone else noticed the wink or if it would have meant anything to them if they had. It was such a small thing, but at the risk of hyperbole, it was one of the greatest moments of my entire life, and I was never, ever the same again, ever, ever. Too much? Okay, maybe it's too much. I might be overstating it a bit, but I'll tell you why it mattered to me, for real. After so many listens to the album and imagining what the show might look like, I'd spent the entirety of Act One utterly enwrapped by what was unfolding on the stage. The wink gave me the tiniest glimpse into the life that continued to unfold off stage. Life continued in the wings and in the dressing rooms. There were probably genuine friendships, embraces, inside jokes, private moments that we were witnessing the whole time and didn't even realize. They were incorporating it all into the show. Life and art, then, were intrinsic and even interchangeable. Boundaries could be erased between the two, and the result was a more deeply felt experience, a richer experience. Life was happening before they entered the stage, and it didn't stop once they made their exits. This wasn't a museum piece. It was not fixed in time. It was a living, breathing thing, susceptible to change, as subtle as a wink. The theater became a 4D experience for me in that moment. The cost of my ticket had been $20. There was no dollar amount you could place on the experience I had that afternoon. Afterward, I no longer dreamed solely of the day I would become a cast member in my favorite Broadway show. I dreamed of a life where the art didn't stop just because I left the stage. Life can turn on a dime. At the end of my junior year of high school, a few months before my 17th birthday, I spent hours in line for my chance to be heard. Rent was holding an open call in my city at a nightclub on 8th Street called Shampoo. Standing in that line, which wrapped around the block, I was confident of only one thing. No one would be able to say that they loved this work of art more totally or purely than I. My preparation had made me fearless, and I had no expectations. There's nothing like preparation to make you fearless. As far as prep work was concerned, there was all the time I had spent over years walking toward the thing I loved, and there was the Freedom Theater. Freedom Theater had been a cradle and training ground. I came to it with no knowledge, no experience other than singing in church, and a certain confidence that came from public speaking. As I had the chance to observe the advanced students, who were so polished, I saw a way that I could ascend as they had and make myself proud. There weren't a lot of politics or favoritism at Freedom. As a student, you rose in the ranks based on your merits. Anyone who was in that advanced class was there because they had earned it. Many of the students had been studying since they were 4 or 5 years old. I had a lot of catching up to do. The discipline appealed to me. I was up for the challenge. I loved the fun and silliness of performing most of all. The art of being silly is vastly underrated, in my opinion. I was hooked on the joy. By the time I was in high school, I sought further training. The Philadelphia Dance Company, Philadanco, in West Philadelphia, has a long track record and an esteemed reputation for its rigorous and thorough training of black dancers. Philadanco was founded by Joan Myers Brown, a talented and driven black ballerina and native Philadelphian. Growing up, she saw firsthand the limited professional and educational resources for black dancers in the city, especially when it came to the classical arts. Joan responded by starting her own professional modern dance company and world-class training program. Today, Joan's company, Philadanco, is one of the most venerable professional dance companies in the country, and its training program is second to none. It is a rigorous, varied, and serious program for serious dancers. I was the worst in the class, by far. Look, I say it with a smile, but I mean it completely. Being the worst is a gift in your training. I've pulled up the rear more times than I can count. If you can help it, you want to study in close proximity to people whom you feel you can learn from. And there's no better place to be in a dance class anyway than on your toes. I loved the rigors of my early ballet classes and the incremental improvements I was able to see in myself from week to week. It kept me inspired, kept me hungry. Lessons learned in that West Philadelphia dance studio are with me always. My early dance teachers taught us a head-to-toe body awareness and gave us a world-class technical foundation. If you could cut it at Danko, you could cut it anywhere. The hours and hours of preparation at Philadanco and Freedom gave me the confidence that I could be a contender as I stood in the line in front of Shampoo waiting for my audition number. We all have our versions of auditions, right? Tests and tryouts at school, interviews for colleges and jobs. There's a scrutiny we face whenever we choose to pursue an opportunity we desire. Nerves creep in and threaten your ability to do your best. Pressure and nerves are real, but they don't have to be crippling. The difference in how you fare can sometimes come down to where you place your focus. You can focus on how much you hate the feeling of being judged, or you can focus on appreciation and gratitude for the fact that every audition brings you closer to the place you desire to be. Every no you'll hear is a no on the way to your ultimate yes. You don't have a thing to be afraid of. The Rent audition process was just about the most fun I could imagine. It's exhilarating to be that close to something you've dreamt about. I sang my favorite song in the world for the casting directors, the Donny Hathaway arrangement of For All We Know. There might not be a more inappropriate song I could have chosen as audition material, but I had no idea. The song wasn't pop. The song certainly wasn't rock, both of which were what they asked for. But my love and exuberance spoke well for me, and I got a call back for later that afternoon. They gave me a cassette tape and sheet music for a handful of songs they wanted me to be prepared to perform when I returned. I sailed through the new tunes at the callback as if I'd been practicing them for years. Because I had been practicing them for years. The initial audition in Philadelphia was in the spring, just weeks before the start of summer vacation. Over the next few months, the casting office requested my presence in New York 3 times for different phases of the audition process. I sort of thought, they must have a database of hundreds of hopefuls from around the country. If I do really well, they'll put me in that database. Maybe a few years from now, a slot will open up and I'll get my chance. It was big local news, huge local news, when R&B singer Jill Scott was cast in the Canadian tour of Rent. Jill had waited in the same line that I did, outside Shampoo, for her chance to be seen as well. She was already a major superstar in our hometown. The city celebrated with her when her number was called, and she was given the chance to shine on a bigger stage. My number was called just a short time later. It was before work on a Monday morning. I had a summer job at the local NAACP. I was on my way out the door. I got paid to answer phones, take messages, open and sort through mail and whatnot. The phone rang, and I had a funny feeling. It sounded different to me. Hello? Hello, may I please speak to Leslie Odom Jr.? A cheery voice on the other end inquired. This is Leslie. Hi, Leslie. This is Brig Burney calling from the company management office of the Broadway and Touring Companies of Rent. How are you? I'm fine. Good. Well, all of us over here were just crazy about your last audition, and we would love to offer you a spot in our Broadway company. What do you think? The position would start immediately. I couldn't believe it. Are you serious? I'm very serious, Brig said with a smile in his voice. Brig has since become a friend of mine, and he's still one of the kindest people you'll meet in the big city. He's told me that at the time, making these calls, giving people their first opportunities to walk onto a Broadway stage, being the first to deliver the news to someone that their dream was coming true, was his favorite part of the job. We're sending you a train ticket, Brig said. Okay, but you don't have to do that, I told him. My parents will say yes. I mean, I have to ask them first, but they'll say yes. They'll drive me. I had just been invited to join the Broadway company of Rent for exactly 1 month. It was 2 weeks after my 17th birthday and the end of summer in 1998. Arrangements were made for me to take a leave of absence from school. My parents drove me to New York the very next day. I picked up my script, got a dressing room assignment, and had my very first blocking rehearsal on stage at the Niederlander Theater on Broadway. In 24 hours, my summer job had gotten a major upgrade. My personal feeling about the luck of the beginner is that it has a lot to do with the absence of cynicism. Beginners are too filled with optimism for cynicism to dim their light. They're too filled with joy for jadedness to dampen their enthusiasm. This magnetizes the beginner. And it isn't about youth. It is about freshness and openness and love. Who wouldn't want to be around that? Every now and then, it is the job of the veteran to reconnect with the beginner inside. As an adult, once you enter the real world, Your lack of cynicism can go by the wayside quicker than you think. Once your dream is tied to how you pay your rent and put food on the table, it's easy to forget the joy you felt at the outset. When your dream shows up, I hope you'll make a commitment to yourself to meet it with as much childhood joy and wonder as possible. My Broadway contract was extended twice. The guy I was temporarily replacing was out on injury, and each time his doctor suggested he take a little more time, my dream was extended for 4 more weeks. Ultimately, I got to hang out in the building for 3 months. On stage, as you can imagine, I was in heaven. The heavy lifting had been done long before I suited up and stepped onto the stage at the Nederlander. By the time I'd arrived, the show had been open for 3 years. It was a Tony and Pulitzer Prize Award winner and a runaway success at the box office. It was one of the most coveted jobs on Broadway. The audience was filled with people who loved the show as much as we did. Everyone in that cast knew how lucky we were to be a small part of giving away this phenomenon each night. The themes of the piece, woven with great care by creator and composer Jonathan Larson, were made painfully resonant by his sudden and untimely death on the eve of Rent's first off-Broadway preview. There was a reverence and a responsibility we carried with us when we stepped onto that stage. You would have had to be thick-headed and insensitive to miss the vibe. It was in the wood. The feeling was in the scaffolding. The show always connected with people. It always worked. All you had to do was play your position, hold up your little end, and the evening would soar. The night of my first performance, Tina O, the show's dance captain, offered to take me out for a quick bite before the 8 o'clock curtain. Tina had spent the week getting me up to speed. As a replacement in a Broadway show, you get a week to learn your part and then you're on. Tina took me to a bistro on the corner of 41st and 8th. We talked about our hometowns and our training. She told me all about when she moved to New York. She filled me in on her career as a professional ballet dancer. I'd spent the week learning from Tina during the days and then watching her laser-sharp, exquisite execution of the show at night. I was a big fan, huge fan. Tina was in her mid-20s. As was most of the cast. I'd had a hard time connecting with people during that first week. It's no wonder. I may have felt like a grown-up on the inside, but I was still very much a kid. I couldn't drink. I couldn't get into bars or clubs. No one had very much interest in hanging out at the soda shop with the high school senior. An hour or so into our meal, Tina told me she had a gift for me. She pulled out something wrapped in tissue paper. And there was a card attached. Even before opening anything, her kindness had rendered me speechless. The card read, "Dear Leslie, congratulations. Take a deep breath tonight and a snapshot of this moment in your mind. A Broadway debut only happens once. Break a leg. You're going to be wonderful." Inside the tissue paper was a leather-bound journal. A deep gratitude lodged in the center of my chest. I was full in a way that I hadn't yet experienced in my young life. And that night, I made my Broadway debut. Rent begins with the entire company making their entrance together. For about 30 seconds after that, the audience would routinely go nuts. I'd watched the same reaction for a week at this point. Tonight was no different, except for the fact that on this night, I was among the lucky ones who got to be on the receiving end of all that energy. I took my place on stage alongside the rest of the company and looked out at an audience already going wild. I thanked God. I took my mental snapshot and a very deep breath. I smiled and I winked at Tina. From then on, this would be the bar against which I would measure all other creative experiences. Does it feel as good as that felt? Do I feel the same sense of fulfillment as I felt during that time? Rent was artistically fulfilling, culturally relevant, and commercially successful. It doesn't get any better than that in the world of entertainment, and it doesn't come around that often. It would be 15 years or so until I found my way into a piece of work that would hit all those notes again. The interim years were filled with effort, some success, plenty of failure, and faith. Faith will deliver the reminder that disappointment and failure don't have to be fatal. In those times when you've done your very best and still come up short, faith fills in the gaps between your reality and your dreams. Faith is what sustains you in the wilderness. For 3 months, I was treated like a professional actor. I joined the union. I paid taxes and put away money for retirement. At the stage door, I signed rent tickets and programs and took Polaroids with fans. It was a huge leap forward for me and a dream realized. It would be hard to argue with someone who might call that my big break. You hear a lot about the big break from successful people, but I would challenge you to think of your big break as an inside job instead of something that you'll find externally. The external world will eventually mirror what you begin on the inside of yourself today. When I got back home to Philadelphia, I was committed to whatever hard work it was going to take to make sure I saw a Broadway stage once more. The biggest break is the one you will give yourself by choosing to believe in your vision, in what you love, and in the gifts you have to offer the waiting world. Chapter 3. What You Own. Now what? The voice in your head. I left Rent right before the holidays in 98. Back to Philly. I hated to admit it, but I was run down and in serious need of a break. By my final curtain call, I was just a few days ahead of a nasty flu that would knock me completely out of commission for a couple weeks. None of this should have surprised anyone. It takes time to build up the stamina to do 8 shows a week on Broadway, and I'd gone from crawling to walking so quickly. When I was hired initially, I was given a 4-week contract. Prior to that, the longest run of a show that I had ever done was maybe 4 performances total. I was used to school plays and community theater. Some shows opened and closed within the same weekend, so from the start, the prospect of getting to do Rent 32 times on a Broadway stage was almost too good to be true. When 1 month turned into 3 months, the physical toll of almost 100 shows was significant. Rent is a notoriously challenging score. The show was many singers' first professional job in the theater. Sadly for some, it would be their last. Without solid vocal training, singing a rock score 8 times a week can trash your voice. I remember losing my voice for the first time a few weeks into my contract. Singing training for me consisted of the choir and church, the hours I'd spent messing around on a karaoke machine that I was given one Christmas, and the hundreds of hours I'd logged with Mom and Dad's record collection. Having my voice gone in a moment was pretty terrifying. The powerlessness you feel is not easy to put into words. It makes you realize in the most profound way that any talent you have is a gift. Whether it's creative, athletic, or intellectual, however it manifests, talent really is given to you. We are all given a portion at the starting gate, and we've done virtually nothing to earn it. He's a natural. It is a gift. The truth is, some gifts come to us easily. Losing my voice is a lesson in how easily they can vanish. I believe it is by design. There will be plenty to fight for down the line. Some things should come easy. And you know what else? Talent isn't everything. Talent is nice. In some instances, it is a leg up, but it's only a part of what you'll need for success, ultimately. Hard work and perseverance are almost more important. It is possible to marry a meager talent to enduring success with a strong work ethic. It is just as possible to squander a major talent with laziness and inaction. Assess what you've got, be honest with yourself, and make the most of whatever you've been given. I had a lot more developing to do.